Coming up today on Hometown Heroes, a World War II veteran who just hit the first hole-in-one of his career at age 93. This Bronze Star recipient will tell us about that and his 4.5 years in the Army, including some harrowing days in the Philippines.
Well, I didn't ever give up hope. I was always ready to come home.
Don't miss Hometown Heroes today at 1 on News Talk 580 or at 5 p.m. on FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ. Each week we visit with World War II veterans. We honor them for their service, for the sacrifices that they made, really for our sake, the future generations of Americans at that point, that they didn't know if they would have a future, but we do because of that greatest generation. So we honor them each week. We try to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, and we learn a whole heck of a lot along the way. That's the plan for today, but I do need to give you a little disclaimer. If you're listening on our FM 105.9 at 5 p.m., pay no attention to this. If you're listening online at kmjnow.com, it won't affect you either. But if, like most Hometown Heroes listeners, you are tuned in to KMJ News Talk 580 on the AM side of the dial, you probably know that Bulldog football is coming up today. So at 1:30 this afternoon, we will be breaking away to Bulldog football and pregame Bulldogs Live as the Dogs take on fourth-ranked Oregon with a kickoff at 3:30. So just wanted to give you a heads up. And if you do miss the second half of the program, you can, of course, tune in later at 5 p.m. on FM 105.9. I hope that all made sense to you, and I hope you're going to enjoy what you're about to hear. Our guest today, 93-year-old Alan Tootle of Visalia, California. He'll be 94 next month. And, you know, most of the time when I hear about veterans to have on this show, it's you, the listeners, who send me an email, give me a call, and say, you need to talk to so-and-so. He's got some great stories from World War II. That's not how this one happened. I happened to be reading the Fresno Bee, and just a little tiny piece of print somewhere said, hole-in-one, Exeter Golf Course, first hole-in-one. And then it printed your age, 93, and I wasn't sure if that was a typo or not. So I got to get this story. When did you first pick up a set of golf clubs? How long have you been swinging those things?
I bought my first set of golf clubs in 1950, a used set, and went out on my own, no lessons, and clubbed my way to many years of golf.
Well, that's the Oakey way, right?
Absolutely. It's been a fun ride.
And I say that because Mr. Tootle did come over as a child from Oklahoma in the wake of the Dust Bowl and moved out here to California. And we're going to hear more about that. But let's this hole-in-one now. So 1950. So I imagine you've played golf throughout those 62 years off and on, and in recent years pretty consistently, right?
Since retirement, yes. But in the travels, everywhere we found a golf club, we played. Stayed overnight and played that golf course.
And every golfer wants to hit a hole-in-one. I've had one gentleman on this show who has 13 of them in his career. But I imagine over those years, a time or two, you came close and maybe thought about giving up?
Yeah, I thought, hey, I'll never do this. Mm-hmm. Came close a lot of times, but never in the hole.
Now, I have to imagine there aren't too many people. Well, first of all, there aren't too many people who live to 93, but let alone hit their first hole-in-one at age 93. You think you've got a record there?
Well, probably close to it, but there's a lot of luck to it, too.
Tell me about it. Give me the play.
That's right. Early in the morning, a short par three hole, 140 yards approximately, and over the lake and through a sand trap and in the hole.
Through the sand trap and in the hole. How did that happen?
I thought it went clear over the green, but my partners pulled it out of the hole for me.
So I have to know, when you saw that, when he pulled that out of the hole, what was your reaction to that after all these rounds of golf for all these years?
I told him he was full of baloney. I wouldn't do that.
You thought he was pulling your leg and planted the ball?
Right. I couldn't believe that I did, but I was happy about it anyway.
And I imagine you weren't the only one happy about it. Has the word spread around here that you pulled this off?
All over town. Mm-hmm. All over the golf course, Lady Jill, she's the one that put it in the paper up there. She's real happy for me. She keeps asking me, what am I going to do about it?
Well, what are you going to do about it?
Save my money. I'm not going to buy drinks for everybody.
Did you get some folks trying to bring you into that?
Yeah, I got hooked for that already.
You can tell them that they can wait for your second hole in one, and then you'll take care of it, huh?
They'll dry up probably for before the next one.
Well, and I guess that's the other question I have to ask you that folks at home are probably saying, well, what's he going to do now? You play all the way till age 93, almost 94, you get your first hole in one. Are you going to call it quits, or are you going to keep gunning for number two?
Well, I'm going to buy a new set of golf clubs, I think.
But these ones got you a hole in one. That 7-iron, don't get rid of that.
It works all right, but I'd like to have a new set of clubs.
All right, let's take you back in time now to long before you ever picked up a golf club. As I mentioned, your family came out from Oklahoma during the Great Depression and during the Dust Bowl. You grow up here in Tulare County. You graduate from Visalia High School, where the Redwood campus is now. And then Uncle Sam gets a hold of you. When you were drafted into the Army, was that something that you were excited about, or you were a little frustrated because you had other plans of your own?
Well, he took the best years of my life. That's what happened. Mm-hmm. 4.5 years. I didn't really want to go because I had just got married, and I didn't have any particular ideas to go to the service. But that Uncle Sam caught me.
And the same thing happened to millions of other Americans. Did it help at all to know that other people were going through the same thing you were going through?
Yeah, I made a lot of friends all on the same track.
Well, and one question I like to ask everybody who's on this show is about December 7th, 1941, because everybody I've talked to who was alive then seems to remember something. You were stationed at Camp Roberts by Paso Robles at the time?
That's right.
What do you remember about that day and how you found out that the Japanese had attacked?
The radio. We had the radio on. No television then.
And you were on leave?
That's right. 3-day pass. The word got out real quick. Everybody returned to their base. And they took me over to the highway and said the first car that came by picked me up and brought me right back to the camp.
And when you were drafted, you knew you'd be in the service for a year, right?
I went in for a year of this mandatory conscription, as they call it, you know. I stayed 4.5 years.
And you didn't know at the time how long it was going to be, whether it be a year, 2 years, or 4 years. So what was the atmosphere like there at Camp Roberts after this big news that war had started and now everybody was at the ready? What was it? Was it chaotic there, would you say?
I would say nobody knew anything what to do. It was just a big, like you say, chaotic.
And you've got a wife to think about, too.
I was married in August, and I was planning on getting out.
What did they do with you instead?
Said, stand here all time, ready to go. So about a year later, I went up to Fort Ord. And then to a few months, I went to Camp Stoneman, and from there overseas.
And obviously, you're following what's happening in the world. You'd heard a little bit about what's going on in Europe. Obviously, December 7th brought you close to what was happening in the Pacific. Were you hoping to go one way or the other?
I had no choice. They say you will go that way. But it was all right.
And being a child of Oklahoma who drove out here to California, Had you ever been on a ship before? They put you on a troop ship and sent you to the Pacific?
I just barely seen the ocean a time or two. I had no conception of what a big ship was like.
So how long did it take you to get your sea legs? What was it like on that ship?
With 4,000 troops on an old banana boat, I think it was. We went to Australia. It was crowded in there. I never did stay below deck. It just wasn't for me.
You were too afraid to go down below where you couldn't see what was happening?
I didn't like the smell of 4,000 people.
I'm pretty sure I wouldn't either. So what did they do with you? What kinds of assignments were you given? You were in a service company. What did that mean for you?
Service company is where all the clerks and service people that done things for the other companies in the regiment. They all say it was a glory company and we didn't have to go up front, you know, but we did anyway.
Yeah, the people who didn't know said that, I'm sure. And this was with the 19th Infantry Regiment of the 24th Infantry Division that some people might be familiar with from the Pacific. Your day-to-day duties, what were the biggest things that you had to make sure to take care of?
To make sure the trucks were out and keeping supplies on the move. The drivers had to go up, haul stuff up front and bring dead people back.
I'm sure that was not something that escaped you, that you saw some of those dead people coming back. How hard was that to see that this is war, this is real, and people are dying?
They weren't really my friends as such, and I didn't know them, but they were a body, and it was awful.
And I don't want to make you dwell on it, because I can tell it's difficult, and it brings up emotions. But for us, for the people that weren't there, that didn't experience it, paint a picture for us of what that was like. Are we talking truckfuls of dead servicemen that are coming back? Or tell us what you remember about that.
Well, they were on stretchers and put on top of each other, just like cordwood in there, you know. It wasn't funny.
And I'm sure, even though you said you didn't know them, they weren't your friends, you had friends, and you were there. And there's part of you probably that says, next time that could be me or my friends. Is that fair to say?
That's true. Absolutely.
So as you start to experience this and you're confronted with the harsh realities of war, did you find something that helped you stay motivated, stay focused, stay moving forward so you would get home someday?
Looking forward to the day it was over. I could go home. But it turned out all right for me. I didn't get a Purple Heart. I got a citation or two, but it didn't mean much.
Well, and you made it home, so 60-something years later, you could hit your first hole-in-one, as we've already heard. What was your first glimpse of real combat and bullets flying, shells going here and there, bombs exploding perhaps? Was there a moment for you that said, wow, that's insane?
Red Beach 1 in Leyte on the Philippines. That was the toughest part.
And your division, the 24th Infantry Division, is one of the organizations that made that landing at Leyte. That was in 1944, October 1944, so just after your birthday, I suppose. And how early on in the battle were you hitting that beach?
Unloading supplies, trucks, tanks. We had all of these in our regiment, trying to get them onto the beach, and it was bad.
And when you say it was bad, I know there's a lot more detail behind that statement. What did you see, and what was flying at you? When you say it's bad, it tells me that you guys weren't getting a welcome party from the Japanese.
No way. And we stayed there on the beach, I think, for 2 days before we could move.
And you couldn't move because what was happening?
Because they had us pinned down there. You moved, you got shot at.
So there's artillery shells, machine gun fire, and were you seeing vehicles, materials, people get hit around you?
Right. Some of them didn't make it to the shore, still in the water. That was bad.
And I imagine in your role, and you said how others had teased you guys in service company that you were a glory company and you wouldn't have to deal with any of this. But it seems to me if you're responsible for getting these vehicles ashore, you're probably pretty exposed to the enemy fire.
Well, I stayed behind a coconut log, a palm tree log for 2 days, I think. But I was out there with them.
That's an awful long time to be pinned down in one spot. An awful long time to have stuff run through your mind. Can you remember at all what was going through your mind?
To come out of there safe and get that over with.
Did you find yourself thinking of folks back home or saying a prayer, or what kinds of things did you do to pass the time?
Well, after a while, it kind of got fun because we could see what we were doing. We were making headway, you know, and it turned out real good. We got over that.
Was it ever imposing or intimidating for you, the responsibility that you felt with all this heavy equipment being your responsibility and people's lives at stake?
Well, I knew we had a job to do, and we were assigned whatever to do, and we had tried to do it, and I guess we done a pretty good job.
And I'm sure everything always went exactly according to plan, right?
Every time. Never. You done with what you had because you couldn't get supplies right as you need them. A lot of our trucks were tied up because we didn't have any tires for them. Tires would wear out. Roads were these old cobble roads and so on. We done with what we had and it skimped through.
Well, I think we need to hit our first commercial break right now, but when we come back, we'll have more with 93-year-old Alan Tootle of Visalia, a veteran of the 24th Infantry Division in World War II. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
That bed, I heard my wife say, in a way that I knew she was either really, really happy or really upset. Paul Leffler here for Sleep Retreat, and if it had been the latter, I wouldn't be telling you about it. No, she was excited. That bed, she said, is so comfortable. She had just gotten her first taste of our new Tempur-Pedic mattress from Sleep Retreat, Fresno's only premium bedding store. And I'm not making this up, she didn't want to move. That's how much she loves the comfort and support that Tempur-Pedic's technology delivers. This is not one mattress fits all. The trained professionals at Sleep Retreat can walk you through the whole spectrum from soft to firm. But the one thing all the Tempur-Pedics have in common is they adapt to your exact shape to support every part of your body. If you've slept on a conventional mattress your whole life, like I have, this is something you've never experienced before. Do yourself and your sleeping habits a favor by trying out the most recommended bed in America. Visit your Tempur-Pedic Comfort Center in Central California. That's Sleep Retreat on El Paso next to Fashion Furniture.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Alan Tootle of Visalia, is just full of surprises, I tell you. He waited till age 93 to hit his first hole-in-one, as we discussed. And when he humbly mentioned earlier in the program that he had a few citations, what he didn't tell me, he has a Bronze Star. And there's an article here from the Visalia Times-Delta, September 6, 1945, almost exactly 67 years ago. It says, Sergeant Thomas A. Tootle won the Bronze Star for heroic achievement against the Japanese on Leyte and Mindanao in the Philippines while serving with the 24th Infantry Division. Tootle, actually, they misspelled your name. They said Tottle. We should have him run a correction for you. Tootle, a truck master, maintained the vital flow of supplies to the rapidly moving forward elements in the 24th Division's lightning drive across Mindanao. When units were spread over wide areas, he had to convey his trucks over mine-strewn roads, which often extended as far as 135 miles. Adverse weather conditions and the constant danger of ambush, as well as a shortage of vehicles and drivers, added to his difficulties. Major General R.B. Woodruff said Sergeant Tootle's thoroughness and devotion to duty reflect high credit upon himself and the military service. And then it references your father living in Visalia because you weren't home from overseas yet. So that is what the government had to say about your service in World War II. The Bronze Star is a very prestigious decoration. I think you were just happy to be home. And you were telling me a little bit about being in the Philippines. You made the landing at Leyte. Your division also had the Luzon action, and they're talking about Mindanao there. In general, being in the Philippines during this time of the war, what was it like? It sounds pretty treacherous to me.
In the first place, it rained every day. Rain, rain, rain. And you slept in the poncho, sitting on the ground, if you could. But anyway, weather was lousy. You had to make your own roads for your big trucks because they didn't have any that you could utilize.
The roads were all too narrow for the big trucks?
Big trucks and muddy roads, overgrown with brush. You know, you couldn't see ahead what was up there. And that's where we got ambushed, was in these convoys. But we managed to keep the boys fed on up.
When you managed to make it home, and I imagine that wasn't easy. Some close calls that you reflect back on?
Well, strafed with airplanes, bombed when we were on another island, Mindanao, tried to run us off. We managed to stay there anyway.
You know, earlier you mentioned something about not having the Purple Heart. It made me wonder if there were some times where you thought you were going to be coming home with a Purple Heart.
Well, anytime you're in the zone like that, you can expect to either get hurt or killed. So I was just lucky I didn't have a scratch.
Give me an example maybe of a moment where after it was over you said, "Whew, that was close." And thanked your lucky stars you were still there.
I said that the night I got discharged and I walked out that door and I said, "Thank the Lord, it's over."
You said you guys had to make your own roads. How'd you do that?
Just plowed through. We had 4 8-wheel drive vehicles and just plowed them out. Go out through the brush and make your own roads.
And I'm sure that was real great for the vehicles. I imagine some of them had to be fixed after that.
It was a job keeping them running and get parts. And like I said before, we tried to keep them going, and a lot of times we didn't have tires for the trucks and just had to set them back and leave them behind. Or if we moved Jeeps, they'd steal our Jeeps. That was a bad thing.
And you had a Jeep at your personal disposal?
Right, with 30 caliber machine gun on it.
Did you ever have to use that thing?
We used it to strafe if we were going into strange territory. Shoot a lot, hoping that you cleared the way for your trucks to get through. So you don't know what you done, but you shot a lot.
In terms of that day-to-day existence for you, what was the most difficult thing for you to deal with?
Probably thinking of maybe the people that are up there farther on up ahead, and you didn't have to be right up there with them. You just thank the Lord you were back most of the time behind and trying to keep them service and supplies. Food and ammunition, whatever.
And there's more of this conversation with Mr. Tootle if you're listening to us on the FM KMJ 105.9 or online at kmjnow.com. You'll hear the conclusion after this. If you're on News Talk 580, pregame coverage of Fresno State and Oregon is straight ahead with Bulldogs Live.
For years, Paso Robles has been known for the Mid-State Fair and its world-class wineries. Coming Saturday, September 29th, a new event will join those two. Estrella Warbird Museum, in conjunction with the Plains of Fame Air Museum, presents Warbirds Over Paso. Thrill to the roar of P-51 Mustangs, a P-38 Lightning, F-4U Corsair, and even a North American B-25 bomber. Tour the C-47, a true veteran of World War II, and see many more in breathtaking flybys. See the world's only N-9M flying wing, forerunner of the B-2 stealth bomber. Warbird rides available before and after the flying display. Gates open 8 a.m. Admission $20. Active duty military and kids under 12 free. Admission includes open house at the museum, free parking, food and beverage vendors on site. Sponsored in part by Firestone Walker Brewing Company, it's Warbirds Over Paso, Saturday, September 29th at the Paso Robles Municipal Airport on Airport Road off Highway 46. Call 805-277-0440 or go to ewarbirds.org/airshow. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I apologize for any confusion caused by the football situation. The Bulldogs are taking on the Oregon Ducks tonight. And you might remember in past football seasons, Hometown Heroes would often be preempted completely by Bulldog football. But I do want to thank our program director, Skip Essick, who had the foresight to make sure that Hometown Heroes airs on our FM station, 105.9, also at 5 o'clock every Saturday. So even when there is a football game on our AM station, you can still hear Hometown Heroes every week on the FM side of the dial. Continuing on with our guest now, 93-year-old Alan Tootle of Visalia, California. He's going to turn 94 next month. You heard him talk about that first career hole-in-one he experienced last month out in Exeter. You've also heard quite a bit about his experience in the Army, serving as a truck master in the service company of the 19th Infantry Regiment, part of the 24th Infantry Division, spending a lot of his time in the Philippines during World War II. Did you have any concept? I've asked a lot of guys this question because most veterans tell me that they were aware of what was right around them, but the big picture a lot of times was lost on them. Did you have any idea of how important what you and the guys around you were doing was to the bigger picture of the war in general?
You don't think of those things like that too much because you do your job and that's it. Try to keep your supplies to them and you know they need it.
How was the food?
Well, if you want to eat out of a can, it's real good.
And a lot of veterans in the Pacific especially have shared with me stories of getting sick, catching tropical illnesses, or dysentery from eating stuff that wasn't so good. Did you ever run into any of that?
Malaria was common in almost everybody.
Yeah.
And the way we suppressed it, we took Ativan.
Uh-huh.
It didn't come out, you know, it didn't make you sick or anything, and you didn't know you had it. As long as you took your Ativan. But after I got home and quit taking that, I got malaria. And I was down, I guess, for probably a month or 6 weeks.
Ooh.
Every 12 hours, you would have a chills and fever.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally got a hold of a doctor here that had some brains, and he gave me stuff to cure it. So I was lucky.
Boy, what a nightmare.
Yeah, it isn't anything to laugh at. It colors your skin, turns you yellow. But I came out all right from it and no after effects that I know of.
What did you find yourself missing the most about home while you're half a world away?
A good bed at night. Rained every day, like I said. You tried to keep dry, which you didn't, and you slopped in the mud halfway to your knees. Trying to set up a camp is always all-night work. I don't want it again.
The more that you were over there, did you find yourself building some friendships with the guys around you, and how close did you guys become?
Buddy. You had to get results from some of them. They were a little reluctant sometimes, but they had to do their job.
How often did you hear from home?
Probably once a month, something like that. Mail call was real important. If you get one letter, you're really lucky.
And you were in the service, as you said, 4.5 years. You talked about Uncle Sam taking the best years of your life. That's 365 days a year for the most part. So we're talking holidays, birthdays, all of that. Any specific memories of spending a Thanksgiving or Christmas overseas and how different that was?
Really didn't celebrate any days. You just passed them over and let them go and done your job and forgot about it. Christmas was one you thought about more than anything, I think.
What'd you think about? Because you're not exactly around the fireplace opening stockings.
Yeah, you weren't home celebrating with the family and this kind of thing. It brought a lot of memories, yeah.
Do you ever remember feeling hopeless or like you weren't sure this was ever going to end? Because there's a big, we know now how long the war lasted, but at the time, I'm imagining there had to be a lot of uncertainty for you.
Well, I didn't ever give up hope. I was always ready to come home. And the quicker you get it over, that's what we could do.
Now, forgive me if I ask you some dumb questions, but I sometimes am reminded that many people, especially my age and younger, don't really know what was happening in World War II. And an answer that might seem really obvious to you might be a real eye-opener for some others. I'm curious if you could define for us what you felt your purpose over there was and if you knew why you were there and what you were fighting for.
Well, there was somebody that tried to beat us down, and we didn't like that. Pearl Harbor started it, and we had to finish it.
And you mentioned hearing about it on the radio back at Camp Roberts. Another thing that a lot of veterans have shared with me, and even people that maybe hadn't agreed with him politically, but I've heard from a lot of veterans that hearing President Roosevelt's speech after Pearl Harbor and even knowing what he was doing and saying throughout the war had some inspirational value for them. Was that your experience, or what do you remember about him?
I don't think I heard that, but I heard portions of it and how he felt about the war. And when he did say that we were in war, that was enough.
You talked about some of the battle situations you were in, and those landings in the Philippines certainly fit the bill. What was your experience or impression of the Japanese soldiers that your troops were fighting against?
They were a lot like the wars of today. They were suicidal. They done anything they could to jeopardize your actions. They were brutal.
How much of that did you see firsthand?
You saw whenever one was captured, you saw what he was like when he got out or got back, and you know how bad it was. I didn't see it firsthand doing it, but...
You mean hearing from American soldiers how they were treated by their Japanese captors?
That's right, yeah.
And what did that produce in you? Was that something that would build you up in anger or wanting some kind of revenge?
No, I didn't feel revengeful at any time. I don't think. We just carried on and done what we had to do.
You know, we talked about your first taste being Red Beach at Leyte, and most people hear that word if they're a student of World War II, and there's a certain general who comes to mind with that location, General MacArthur. How did you feel about him, and what would you say the take on him among the troops you were with was?
He was all right, I guess. I'm not going to say anything against him. A lot of people didn't like him. A lot of them thought he was a big show-off, run around with that corncob pipe, you know. They said he waded ashore, you know, over there. Well, they carried him. So that's not...
Well, and he wouldn't have been able to wade ashore or be carried ashore if you and the guys who were with you hadn't have recaptured that ground. Does that give you some satisfaction to know that?
Yeah, definitely. That was good to get off of that beach and move on.
As you got closer to the end of the war, was that evident to you that things were getting close, that this might wrap up and you might be able to go home?
It was always good to hear that they took another island or another landing somewhere. You never got the full story or the good part about it. But when they went into Japan, that was the end of it. It was brutal, we know that, but when they bombed them and so on, that was bad.
Do you remember hearing about that and hearing that the war was over? Do you remember where you were and what that meant to you?
We was on a LST out in the middle of the ocean. We all threatened to jump overboard.
Well, and if you were in a LST out in the middle of the ocean, why do I have a feeling that you were getting ready to do on mainland Japan what you had done in the Philippines, which is get all these vehicles ashore?
That's right. We left Mindoro Island and was on our way.
And I imagine you had an idea that if you got there, when you got there, it wasn't going to be very pretty.
Well, we knew it was going to be bad. It'd be crucial that they do what they had to do first. But they bombed them, so that, I don't know whether it saved lives or not, but it saved our side lives. We know that.
Sounds like it saved your life.
Yeah, and a lot of other GIs, because they would have fought to the end.
Yeah, people have heard this a lot on this show, but the government estimate was that at least 1 million Americans would have died, and countless Japanese, obviously, if America had had to invade, and you would have been there. So you threatened to jump overboard in celebration, and then I bet your thoughts turned to, when in the world am I going to get home? How did that unfold for you?
Why can't we turn around and go back now? But we went on to Japan and stayed there just a few months.
So you were part of the occupation troops for a few months. What kinds of things were you doing there?
We're rebuilding an airfield, air base on Kyushu Island.
And at that point, did your perspective on Japan change, being there, seeing the civilians and interacting with them?
Well, they were friendly, very good to us, fed us a lot of rice. Mm-hmm. Worked good. We had them for work details, and they worked really good. No back talk.
One of the other things that veterans of the Pacific, whether they're the Army, the Navy, the Marines, if I say the name Tokyo Rose, they have a story for me. I've had guys say that they couldn't sleep at night because they heard Tokyo Rose say that they were going to be dead in the morning. What was your experience with hearing that propagandist on the radio?
I took it as propaganda. It never really bothered me in any way, but a lot of people it did. I just let it go in one ear and out. No big deal.
Did you find that pretty much everybody would be listening to her, or were there guys that would try to turn it off?
They tried to turn it out, just say she's propaganda and trying to keep them stirred up, which is, well, that was her job. But it didn't shake me up one way or the other.
Did it ever seem so ridiculous that you knew it couldn't be true?
Well, we knew it wasn't true what all she's put out. But I didn't believe any of it anyway, so let it go.
And I understand you also had a pet monkey for a while?
Yeah, I did. I didn't intend to mention that. My daughter brought that up a while ago. I acquired this little monkey. He was a rambler, a little booger. He was nosy. I smoked cigarettes at that time, and I'd leave him there tied up in the tent or out somewhere, and he'd get my cigarettes and tear them open. He didn't eat them, but he wanted to see what was inside of that paper, I think. So, but he went with me a lot of trips where he rode right up on the Jeep. I put the windshield down, and he would ride right up there, and he was happy to go along for a ride. And I couldn't bring him home. I wanted to, but they said I would have to quarantine him too long after, you know, longer than my stay was scheduled.
Oh, yeah.
So I had to give him away and come home without him.
Well, and, you know, it seems a little silly to suggest this, but I imagine there was some real value in having this pet at your side, and that you probably did form an attachment because he went through some of the things that you went through right alongside you.
Yeah, he did. He listened to gunfire the same as the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a little pet. He'd get mad, you know, at you, and he'd try to bite you or scratch you, something like that. But he was all right. We all enjoyed him. Well, yeah, he slept on the same cot I did.
Well, that was probably good, you know, good security, because there's all those stories about what the Japanese soldiers would do in the middle of the night raiding American encampments. And I guess if you have a monkey, that monkey's probably going to alert you if something's happening.
Everybody wanted to pet him, you know, thought he was part of them, too. So He was popular.
And, you know, I was reading about this Bronze Star earlier. When did you find out you were getting the Bronze Star, and what did that mean to you?
Well, like I said a while ago, it meant 5 points of departure. You could build points on longevity and all these things.
So for you, that Bronze Star was kind of like your ticket home.
Opened the door, at least. Got me on that plane, anyway.
Do you feel like you were a different man when you got home than you were when you headed overseas?
No, I don't think so. I fell right back into workforce and got a job, went to work.
Did it change your perspective on anything, you think, having been exposed to so many Americans dying, 400,000 Americans dying in World War II?
Yeah, you always feel for them, just like you do now, you know. How many died over there for nothing? I say for nothing, I may be wrong.
Well, and I get the sense, usually from World War II veterans, that they feel those 400,000 died for something really important. When you think about that now, and you think about the millions of Americans who weren't alive when all this happened, who don't know what kind of price was paid for their freedom, what do you think it's important for us to know today about you and all the guys like you?
Well, I think they should be taken care of. In other words, their needs, a lot of them are homeless, a lot of them are addicts, come out druggies. That was bad. I think they should be taken care of.
I just want to thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling me a little bit about it, because I know it's not easy to talk about.
No, it's not, and I was glad to get home and glad to be all in one piece, as they say.
Amen.
And a lot of them are coming home today with parts of them missing, which is bad.
Well, and there is an event coming up in about 10 days that is designed to help veterans who are in situations like that. It's called the Central Valley Stand Down. And I'm delighted to welcome in now John Schuler, director of the Central Valley Stand Down. That is coming up Tuesday through Friday, September 18th through the 21st at the VFW Post 8900 on North Blythe in Fresno. Some of you have heard of a stand down before. Some of you haven't. Those who have, you might have a misconception about what it really means. So John's going to clear that up for us. John, what is a stand down all about?
Yeah, Paul, thank you. Stand down is a military term. Stand down originated in the military. It was a way for when you have frontline troops, they're out in the battlefield. They stand down. They go to the rear echelon. It gives them a chance to get hot meals, rearm, regroup, and before they end up back out in the battle zone again. So it's a way for them to get some rest and recuperation.
And so the idea now with all these veterans, and this is not a particular age group of veteran. This is any veterans are able to come to the stand down. And what exactly do you do for them? What is this all about, okay, a stand down in this context?
The concept in the stand down originated in 1988 was around the first stand down originated in San Diego. And originally, the stand down was created by Vietnam veterans. At the time, Vietnam veterans, when we came home from Vietnam, didn't have a place to go, didn't have a place for fellowship. People didn't understand what we were going through. And over the years, the job has changed. A lot of people think of a stand down, they look at veterans on the roadside or veterans at a corner, you know, thinking that the stand down is, well, you know, if these drunks could get their stuff together. The job has changed through the years. The stand down today, it's always been about helping the homeless veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And we stay homeless veterans today, especially today, we're looking at veterans that have lost everything they have due to deployments. It's not about drugs and alcohol. It's about people that have lost their income. The average veteran today being called up from the reserve or the guard loses that income that they've had. You know, the guard and reserve, usually 2 weeks a year, they go play Army, and the rest of the time they work their civilian jobs. Well, they get deployed. They're called up on active duty. And the majority of the time, that civilian job income is gone. Mm-hmm. So they're getting paid as a PFC or whatever in the military. They're getting paid $1,500, $2,000 a month. And they're over there fighting for our country. And their spouses or significant others back here trying to pay the same bills with half the money. And this is today where our job has changed from, you know, the individuals that we still have a lot of homeless individuals that have, you know, they have brain damage, they have traumatic brain damage, they have PTSD issues, mm-hmm. they have a lot of problems mentally and physically, but now we also have the economic downfall that has come upon us. We have families today that are on the streets because they've lost everything. The stand-in is a way to bring the veteran to the services that are provided. We have over 100 services at our stand on. What we do is we set up a tent city. So the most needy homeless have a place to come and stay for this year. This year our stand-in is going from 3 to 4 days. Mm-hmm. And the reason we're doing that is because we service the entire Central Valley. We have veterans coming from Santa Cruz, Jamestown, Porterville, Stockton, Bakersfield, Oakhurst. We have the only 4-day stand-in in the valley. And what we've done this year is we've opening the tents a day early. Mm-hmm. Which gives the, we call them residents, gives the most severely in need, the homeless veterans, a whole day to get there. So when the services open up Wednesday morning, they have 2 full days to go through the services. I say services, we have everything you can think of. We have medical, dental, we have our own court system. And what we do is we bring all the services to the stand down. And this gives the veteran, first of all, gives them a safe place to stay for the 3 nights that they're there. Secondly, it gives them a chance to get hot meals. It gives them a safe place to sleep at night so they don't have to worry about where their meal's coming from tomorrow morning, which living on the streets is a battle in its own.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do at the stand down is we take the most needy veterans and we house them. If you do not have your own zip code, we consider you as homeless. So you may be living in mom and dad's garage or you're on your sister's couch, but if you're a veteran and you're not living in your own place or you're living somewhere that's unfit for a human to be in, you're homeless. So our services are open to any veteran that walks through the front door. These veterans are called day vets.
Mm-hmm.
So they come in and they use the services, but while they're there, we still feed them. We give them clothing if they need street clothing. A lot of clothing we give out to the veterans. Everything is free. We're all nonprofits. Everything is free. If you're looking for a job, we're going to give you decent clothes to go job hunting with. We're going to sit there and we're going to help you write a resume. We're going to help you do the things that you need to be able to do to take your military time, turn it into a civilian concept where a civilian employer can understand that, yeah, I was a platoon sergeant. You know, I have leadership skills. I was a commander. I was a company commander. I have leadership skill. I took care of 300 people. Mm-hmm. And the civilian, a lot of civilian employers have no concept of what these things mean. So the stand-on is open to anybody that needs to come in, and that any veteran that needs help, the doors are open.
That's terrific. It's really an opportunity for some of these guys whose lives have spiraled out of control to get the help they need to get back on track, to have a fresh start. And I know so many have been touched by it over the years. But all these things you're talking about, the materials, the food, the personal hygiene supplies, all this assistance, it doesn't just materialize out of thin air. So I imagine there's probably a way that the people listening right now could help you out a little bit.
You know, thanks, Paul. Every year that we have grown every year. Our numbers are every year we constantly grow, because now we have children. We have pets. You know, we have the veterinarian service that's going to come out this year to look at the pets. You know, we try to keep everything in check. And yes, 90%, 90-95% of what we get is donations donated by the public. We have some very loving groups of people in this town that have supported us for years. But, you know, the things that every year, last year, we ran out of water. Most people think drinking water by the case. We use it by the pallet full.
Mm-hmm.
So every year we're looking for drinking water. We're looking for clothing. You know, we get a lot of men's clothes, we get a lot of women's clothes, but sometimes we're short on the children's clothes, children items.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we work with veterans, Central Valley veterans. We work with veterans all year long. We run a clothing, a food, a hygiene, and a furniture closet. And what we do is we take these things, and as we get veterans into housing because they've lost everything, we take everything we've collected and just give it to the veteran and get them move in to help them start a new life.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So you'll take clothing, obviously food supplies and water, and obviously money.
Yes, definitely. Money talks.
And if someone's out there listening and they've heard what you said and they have this sympathy for the veteran, the appreciation for the price that these people have paid for us, they want to get a hold of you and help you out in this cause. How do they do that?
Yeah, we are a 501c3, so all your donations are completely tax deductible. You can call me. My cell phone number is area code 559-977-3697. That's 559-977-3697. Or you can email me. And my email is bigjohn44@hotmail.com.
And I will put John's number, 977-3697, as well as his email on our website at kmjnow.com. If you go to the Hometown Heroes section, we'll make sure that's there for you. So if you do want to help out, you'll know how to do that. John, thank you so much, first of all, for serving our country and for the great service that you're performing for all these veterans around our valley.
Thank you. You know, we have a beautiful team of people that has come together, and every year it grows. Every year we have more and more people. And any veterans welcome to come out. Again, we're on North Blythe, the VFW 8900, which is basically the corner of Ashland and North Blythe. We're out there to help veterans. Any veteran that walks through the door that needs the help, we're there to help our veterans. This is our way of giving back. It's about veterans helping veterans, and that's what the concept of Stand Down has always been about. It's brothers helping brothers and sisters. You know, we're all brothers and sisters, whether you served in World War I, World War II, Vietnam, Korea, wherever you serve, veterans have always had a handout for veterans. In the evenings, we have entertainment. We have our support groups. We have our PTSD support group. We have NA meetings. We have AA meetings. We have the Women's Combat Support Group, so we have a lot of supports. You know, we talk about all the services that we have, but a lot of the healing comes in the evening when we sit down, when everybody's gone, that's our house, and that's where we sit down, and that's where we get together down the nitty gritty, and that's where the healing's all about, is working with another veteran. So even if you don't need the services and you're a veteran, you just want to come out and have some fellowship with your brothers and sisters, you know, you're more than welcome to come out. It's open to any veteran walks through the front door. Register and come in and see if we can help you.
Well, again, John, thank you. The Central Valley Stand Down, you can find more information at kmjnow.com. Thanks for listening to the program today. I hope you'll join us again next Saturday for Hometown Heroes on KMJ.